Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Andrew Bowser.
And I'm Sapphire Sindallo.
And welcome to Alter Weekly.
Coming up on the show, we talk with two creators from the Monstrous Femme Films Collective. First, we discuss costume design and horror with Emma Kogan. Then, we're joined by Hannah May Cumming to talk about her short film, Fanatico, and what Monstrous Femme Films hopes to achieve in the future.
But first, I should say at the top, it is raining, and you will hear the rain on the microphone pretty much the entire time. I don't think there's any way to stop it from picking up on my mic. So I wanted to let everybody know that we were aware of that.
Mm-hmm. It's just spooky ambiance.
It's spooky ambiance. Yeah.
Get over it.
You got it for free. We're not even charging you any extra for this spooky ambiance.
Exactly. So now you got to add rain to the rest of the podcast.
I know. Yeah.
It's consistent.
Yeah. And some thunder rolling and lightning crashes.
Ooh.
So speaking of spooky ambiance, I've been on a kick of watching like dark mansion movies.
Okay.
Yeah, like, but specifically with a comedic bent.
You are now entering the Bowser Zone, wherein Bowser discusses an obscure horror comedy nobody cares about.
So I watched High Spirits. I don't know if you've ever seen High Spirits.
I have not.
All right, it's crazy. But it's an Irish film from the director Neil Jordan, and Liam Neeson plays an angry, violent ghost, and Steve Guttenberg falls in love with his ghost wife, played by Daryl Hannah from Splash, and it all takes place in this mansion. Then I watched Haunted Honeymoon with Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner, which is almost equally as crazy, but I love it. I love Gene Wilder. To me is, he's just one of my guys. But that all led me to watching Nothing But Trouble. Have you ever heard of Nothing But Trouble? Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase, Demi Moore.
No.
So I am ashamed to admit I had never watched Nothing But Trouble until this week. Because if it's made for anyone, it's made for me. I don't know who else would like this movie, would sit through this movie. Now, the reason I bring it up is because I've just done like a deep dive on why this movie exists and how it exists in the way that it does, which is that it's very expensive. It's like this really expensive, insane horror comedy that arguably doesn't work on any level.
Wow.
Yes. I actually would, I'd love for you to watch it because...
Of course you would.
I don't know. I just think it would be an interesting experiment because it's a wild one. It's about Chevy Chase and Demi Moore are going on a road trip. Their plan is to go to Atlantic City. And along the way, he's speeding and they get pulled over in like a small town in Pennsylvania. And it turns out it's not as simple as paying this traffic violation. They've got to go to the justice of the peace, the local justice of the peace. And he'll determine what their punishment is. And the local justice of the peace is played by Dan Aykroyd in heavy prosthetics, looking like an insane person who basically traps them in a madhouse with like monsters and mutants. And there's a roller coaster that goes through the house that then goes into a pit called the Bone Stripper, and it kills people. It takes their skin off.
Whoa.
Yeah. So
that's kind of cool.
It does sound
like the roller coaster in the house sounds cool.
Yes. That stuff is really cool. But this is, as I'm watching it, I've known it's this infamous bomb. I've known it's this misfire. And it was the only film Dan Aykroyd directed. And it's loomed large in my, you know, knowledge base, but I'd never sat down and watched it. And the thing that struck me was just how good it looked. It looked fantastic. And the set design is like sprawling, and it felt like they spared no expense. So I had to dig deeper as to like why this film had so much support. It all spawned from Dan Aykroyd watching Hellraiser.
What?
Yeah. Okay. So supposedly he was watching Hellraiser with a buddy. I think they had gone to see a comedy they maybe didn't want to see a comedy because they both worked in comedy. So they opted to see whatever else was out at the theater at the time that wasn't a comedy, and it was Hellraiser. And Dan Aykroyd claims that as they sat there and watched Hellraiser, people laughed, which I find surprising because I would have thought when it came out, it was scary
terrifying
to people. Yeah.
For that audience
at that time. Yeah. But he says that people were laughing, and he walked out of there and to his buddy, he was like, we could make like a horror comedy that was intentionally funny. And that would be a really cool blend. What I find is so interesting is that like Ghostbusters had already happened though, but I guess he didn't see that as a horror comedy, more of like a paranormal comedy.
Same thing.
And so he personally, at some point when he was driving from Canada to New York for SNL, had gotten pulled over in a small town for speeding and had to go to a local justice of the peace and take part in like a kind of kangaroo court scenario where he was then fined $50. But he thought that would be terrifying if you were trapped in a small town and the rules just didn't, you know, apply. The bigger picture rules of society didn't apply. So he started writing the script. And I mean, it's kind of as simple as he took it to Warner Brothers and they're like, sure, $40 million, go make it.
Wow.
But it's because he was plugged in and so big in the comedy scene, and they thought they would partner him with a director like John Landis or John Hughes even. Mm-hmm. And the studio was like, I want John Candy in it. I want Chevy Chase in it. Mm-hmm. I want the biggest star, female star of the time. Demi Moore had just done Ghost and was like hot, you know? And they build out the film with all of those names, and they can't get a director because every director is like, well, the script is garbage. and you know, not for me. And so Dan Aykroyd eventually is like, well, what if I directed it? And Warner Brothers said, yes, sure. Which, I mean, even he would say made no sense. Absolutely no sense. Because there's so many large set pieces. There's so much prosthetic makeup and effects, creature effects, special effect. It like, he was beyond out of his depths. But because of his work as an actor in so many successful films, he was able to gather a really, really efficient crew, including like the production designer from Total Recall and RoboCop and the DP who shot The Thing. So they loved Dan Aykroyd, and basically he was really honest with how little he knew. And they were like, we're here, man. We're here. Like, talk to us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they all worked with him to get the film into shape. And especially because he was kind of forthright with how little he knew as a director and had no ego about it.
Yeah.
They all really rallied around him and pulled off the movie. But along the way, I think certain people like the production designer thought, well, this is going to be like an unending well of resource because it's Dan Aykroyd from Ghostbusters. I'm going to keep asking Warner Brothers for more and more. And anything I pitch to Dan, he falls in love with because he doesn't know, like, you got to cap that stuff. So the production designer would go to Dan Aykroyd and say, what if there was a room and they opened the door just for one gag and there's 300 live bats? And Dan Aykroyd was like, yeah, dude. And so then they'd go to Warner Brothers and get money for that.
Were there actual bats?
Yeah, there's a room that's just bats. And I was like, what a great
not CGI gag. Bats.
Not CGI bats. Bats. Just a bunch of fucking bats. In this.
I hope they were treated okay.
I hope so too.
Every Sorry, time. That's what I think about.
No, but even I do when I'm watching older movies and I see animals. I know. And I'm like, dude, back then they didn't. That back then they'd be like, well, only 10 bats died. Who cares?
Oh, no, that's too many bats.
It's too many bats. They had an idea that like, what if the dinner table was actually a train set and it brought your food around? And they were like, let's go ask Warner Bros. $25,000 for the train set. And they're like, okay. And they just kept saying yes
just
to it.
Did it.
And I don't know why, because nothing in the DNA of this project says blockbuster to me. I mean, and I would I would love this shit. If I had seen it as a kid, I might have loved it. Mm-hmm. But now I do see how detrimentally flawed it is. Also, Beetlejuice had happened. So they thought like, well, so it's like kind of Beetlejuice meets Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Was it though?
Kind of. That's the thing. Hmm. You kind of sit back and you're like, well, that is that. And it doesn't work. So the only thing I would argue is there is no central anchoring comedic performance in Chevy Chase. And, you know, Beetlejuice arguably works because of the charm of that central figure that's able to kind of keep everything together, like magnetically. Mm-hmm. But supposedly Chevy Chase, surprise to no one, was a giant asshole to everybody.
No.
And didn't care that Dan and him had been friends forever. He was like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. I don't want to be here. This movie is, I don't even get it. It's garbage. And just,
and what are you doing there?
And what are you doing? What are you doing there, dude? And what's so weird is you watch the movie and you're like, oh wow, that's Chevy Chase not giving a fuck. You know, he's
pisses me off.
Yeah. It sucks because it could have been saved if someone in that role had maybe said, okay, if I give 110%, more of this will work than won't work. Mm-hmm. But he's giving like, I'd say like a cool 80. And that makes it mostly not work. Demi Moore was all on board. She got along with everyone. And even though she was at some point is tortured by two giant 500-pound baby men, that happens in the film.
What is this movie?
You've got to watch it. So then when it came time to release it, I think there had been a changing of the guard at Warner Brothers, and they watched it and they were like, the fuck is this? Who is this for?
Why did we sign up for this?
At some point, a Warner Brothers executive sent a telegram to Dan Aykroyd that just said, stop the bleeding, talking about the money they were losing. Anyway, they didn't know what to do with it upon release, and they tried to hide the horror aspect of it and make it look friendlier. So the poster had been a painting by Boris Vallejo, who had done, I mean, he's done so much, but had done the Christmas Vacation, all the Vacation posters in that very, you know, epic style. And they did this great horror poster of all the creatures coming out and Chevy Chase holding a femur up as if that's his weapon. And the studio was like, no, we're going to kind of Photoshop some heads together to make this look a little friendlier. And it didn't work. Massive bomb. Obviously, Dan Aykroyd didn't direct anything ever again. People think it also hurt his star power just because it was his name, you know, on like five or six different roles, writer, director, producer, playing three different parts. There's a 15-minute long dance number, a music number from Digital Underground, the group that sang Do the Humpty Hump, come on, do the Humpty Hump. And Tupac Shakur is there.
Wait, what?
I know.
Tupac's in this movie.
Doesn't it sound like I'm making this up?
Yes, I don't believe you.
Believe me, Tupac Shakur.
Tupac has an IMDb credit for this movie.
Yes, that it is his first feature film credit. And he is in the entire 15-minute musical number. And the Digital Underground are like dancing around Dan Aykroyd as he plays organ. I mean,
that was not the direction I thought this was going to go. If I bet money on whether or not you were going to mention Tupac in our opening chat.
Yeah. You'd be like, how do we get there? And how we got there was nothing but trouble.
That is wild. I feel like Tupac being in it for some reason is the most wild thing to me about everything you've said.
As a viewer, it was. I'm watching it and I'm like, okay, this is crazy. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they built that whole mansion facade on the Warner Brothers lot. Oh my gosh, so much money. At one point, Dan Aykroyd has a penis for a nose. Like in a quick like dream sequence, Chevy Chase sees him as having a penis for a nose. All that's crazy. And then Digital Underground walks up and Tupac is there. And I was like, well, this takes the cake. I mean, now it is officially one of the wildest movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
Newsflash. Welcome to your newsflash. First up, Alter has some badass news. The Alter short film Stucco is officially Oscar qualified. What an honor, and a huge congrats to the filmmakers, Janina Gavankar and Russo Schelling. We had them on our very first episode. We couldn't be more excited for them. And what do you say we get you back as guests after you've won? Stucco has hit over 26 million views and is the second most viewed altar film of all time. In an interview with GQ, Viggo Mortensen says, David Cronenberg is going to get back to his origins with a new horror film. Viggo says, it's disturbing and it's good, I think, but since his origins, he's obviously developed in terms of technique and self-assurance as a director. The project is something Cronenberg wrote a long time ago and has never gotten made. They hope to film this summer. John Carpenter is back with a new Lost Themes album entitled Lost Themes 3, Alive After Death. Accompanied by his son Cody Carpenter and godson Daniel Davies, the trio have created a new collection of electronic music. They also collaborated on 2018's score for Halloween, and now just a few years later, Lost Themes 3 is out, February 5th on Sacred Bones. And that's it. That's your Newsflash.
Newsflash.
Monstrous Femme Films is a filmmaking collective focused on producing progressive horror flicks by a variety of diverse horror filmmakers and carving out a place for young women, non-binary, and queer folks in the future of the horror genre. Today, we talk to Emma Kogan, a costumer and a producer, about her love for the genre and how costumes can tell us more about a character than we may think. Then, we talk to Hannah Mae Cumming, a writer, producer, and director, known for her alter short film, Fanatico, about why she loves horror and what she'd love to see more of in the genre.
Well, thank you for joining us, Emma. We're excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So let's just start at the top. What made you fall in love with horror and what made you fall in love with costumes?
Well, gosh, my journey with horror started when I was a kid, primarily through like old sci-fi. I would watch sci-fi and horror, like B-movies with my dad all the time. And for a while when I was a kid, it was just really fun. It was just like a fun escapist adventure. I liked the thrill. And then when I got a little older and I started learning more about film, I was really interested in film that pushed the boundaries of the human condition. And that was something that I wanted to explore through horror, because when I kind of put the puzzle pieces together and realized that horror was that, you know, pushing the boundary, and that was something where you could really explore a person's psyche and kind of work through really traumatic things and just crazy stuff, that's what really drew me to it. And yeah, I just sort of fell into it, and it was something where I just really enjoyed the thrill. I enjoyed like the B-movie aspect, and then kind of adapted that into really enjoying all kinds of horror. Psychological horror is like my jam now. And yeah, I'm just obsessed with all of it. And that sort of costuming, I would say, I fell into at a young age through my grandma, kind of unrelated to horror. And they sort of intersected when I was a young adult. And my grandma was really into fashion history, and that is something that I sort of developed an interest in through my grandma. And we would just talk and talk and talk about fashion history. I would ask her constant questions about why people wore things and why, you know, certain environments led to certain choices in dress, and how that, you know, how you could really read history through what people were wearing. And so, yeah, I sort of got into costume through fashion history. And it costume design wasn't necessarily something I initially wanted to do when working in film. I kind of started with just that interest in like maybe writing, maybe directing, you know, maybe just, I just wanted to create. I didn't really have a set direction, and I guess I still don't. I like to dabble, but I fell in love with costume design when I studied fashion history for a brief time in 2018, and it was just so fascinating to me. And I realized how important costume was to film, and how no matter what route I took with filmmaking, I wanted to have knowledge or be involved with the costume design, because I wanted to explore those psychological elements that drew me to horror and film in the first place through the costume and through the dress. And so, yeah, that's awesome. Kind of where I'm at now. And I've been doing some costume design stuff the last few years, and I'm excited to dabble in more roles and stuff. And yeah, I absolutely love costume design, and it's fun to analyze the little intricate details of films, where especially with horror, where you're like, oh, that's why they're wearing that. Or you can kind of tell what the plot's going to be, like, through the costumes. So, yeah, those are kind of the things that interest me about it and kind of what led me to where I'm at now.
Do you remember what was one of the first costumes you saw specifically in that sci-fi or B-movie genre that you felt like was iconic or that struck you, that maybe stayed with you, that maybe you drew pictures of?
Mm-hmm. That is an amazing question. When I was younger, part of what got me into the B-movie thing was actually just the original Star Trek series. I'm nice. Still obsessed with it to this day and so badly want to make like a retro sci-fi just for the costumes alone, because I think they're brilliant, they're intricate, they're, that's kind of the side that's like, that I enjoy, that's not necessarily super psychological. It's just like really fun and campy, and just really creative. And when I was a kid, I would like try and like make replicas of like props from Star Trek. And
that's cool.
They were real amateur, like we're talking paper mache. And that is what really drew me to that kind of stuff. And so Star Trek costumes were just, I was absolutely obsessed with them. And then I fell in love with horror costuming through things like, you know, Bride of Frankenstein, and kind of, I just loved the details. And I've really, through the last few years, the more I've done costume design on horror films and, you know, worked with costume design, I've grown more fond of appreciating the details in the horror costuming as well.
Do you have a favorite era of costuming in horror films specifically?
Yes, I would say that the 60s, like late 60s and early, well, actually all the 60s, to be honest, and like early 70s, 60s and 70s are, I just think there's, it's like the sweet spot with costuming for me. Recently, I've grown fonder of like, you know, classic horror, like 30s costuming, but that's just, that's a growing interest that I'm still really getting into and diving into. But yeah, I would say my main and my first love of horror costuming is the 60s and 70s, because I just think that it's the, like the socio-political environment of the 60s and 70s, I think created a really interesting environment for the costumes too.
I have to ask, what did you think of the costuming in the Suspiria remake, which was kind of set in that era, but made in the modern times? Mm-hmm. What did you think about that?
I thought it was a really good, I thought it was pretty solid for a contemporary rendition. And, you know, I can appreciate that. I think that, that's one of my favorite remakes of, you know, the recent years. And obviously, absolutely love the original. But I would say, yeah, that they did a good job at making it feel fresh without completely disbanding themselves from the original. And I really, I appreciated that. And I always appreciate callbacks to original films. And I think that that oftentimes can make remakes much stronger.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know where I'm going with this thought, but I'll share the thought in case it goes somewhere. But I was reading an article about how, take Stranger Things, for example, and it's saying we're in the 80s. But what winds up happening is they're really a reflection of highlights, or they're a reflection of nostalgia for a time that isn't actually a reflection of living in that time. Because, you know, living in that time, not everybody was wearing, you know, cut off shirts and had Flock of Seagulls haircuts. Like,
Right. I'm surprised.
So, yeah. How do you go about researching something, I guess, to place it in an era and not just do the highlights and not just reflect the nostalgia, but actually make it feel lived in? I find that, I would assume that's very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that it does depend on the, like, the tone of the film. It's like something like Stranger Things, I think, does rely on those tropes of the given era. And it, because they're trying, I mean, Stranger Things is such like a strong nostalgic.
Right. That's the
feel.
Point of
it's
it.
It's like, yeah, it's like super stylistic. But when you're looking at something that's supposed to be more of a realistic period piece, oftentimes it's like, you're just trying to find, you're going through like yearbooks, like old yearbooks. You're going through old catalogs, and oftentimes like the old like Sears catalogs are really fun to look at. And yeah, you're just trying to find, often it's like asking family members for pictures of people from that era versus just, I mean, you'll do like an initial Google search, but you want to get as much reality in it and talk to people that lived in that era, if possible. That can really broaden your idea of what that environment was like. But yeah, I definitely think that, you know, oftentimes in short films that I've worked in, and you know, a lot of our works with Monstrous Femme Films has often been very like directly like an homage. And so when I'm doing costume design on projects like that, it's really about talking to the director and getting the same vision of like, what direction do you want to go with this? Do you want me to, you know, what you want is you want people, you want the audience to identify it as that period.
Right.
Because if you, what's tricky with that is like, if you go too realistic, and if you say like, if you like don't want to do, because a lot of tropes aren't realistic, and you know, like in the 70s, it's like a lot of people, when they think of the 70s, they're actually thinking of like the late 60s, and so if you were actually to do the early 70s, you'd have to have this balance of like, what do the general, you know, what does the general audience identify as the 70s, and what will immerse them, and what was real. And so it's kind of like you're trying to find that balance that does it for the audience, and you know, what side you strengthen depends on the tone of the film and where the director wants to go with it.
That reminds me of this article I read about, has nothing to do with horror, but the costume designer of Mad Men, the TV series. And I thought it was really interesting because she was talking about exactly what you were saying, how like the outfits that people wore in that show, they weren't completely authentic, but she did that intentionally because she added some sort of, or some contemporary elements, that way modern audiences could still feel like it wasn't too foreign or something. So it's always really fascinating when people do period pieces, because how often is it actually truly a reflection of that time?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good kind of like non-horror example is there's a lot of discourse about like the Little Women remakes, where like the recent one kind of went a little buck wild with not being super period accurate, and they wanted to use like, and like it's like, I think they did it all right. A lot of people don't. But a lot of people do. It's kind of a up in the air. But what they did, they like played with colors, and they wanted to play with textures that sort of represented the character story, because the script was more character driven than the, I think it was the 90s remake, that was more realistic and like realism, and they nailed the period. But the tone was a little different than this remake.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciated that blend of the Greta Gerwig version. I appreciated that it felt more casual in its attempt at representing the era, and more concerned with representing the emotion and those characters. I thought that was cool. Well, what are some of your favorite horror films in regards to the costume design?
I would say it's funny because I actually watched this relatively recently. A couple years ago. It's The Devils by Ken Russell,
which I have never seen.
Oh my gosh, you guys have to see this movie. It rocked me. I was like, it was just unreal. And when I wasn't even like, I love Ken Russell, and it wasn't even the costume design that I loved about it at first, but when I looked closer, the symbolism that they do in the costuming, it's like an early 70s. And this is a perfect example of like what I was mentioning earlier with like loving the 60s and 70s. This is like the prime time example of that. And it is a period piece, but they put like really interesting spins and different accessories that are really interesting. For example, it's sort of, the theme is a lot, there's a lot of worshiping themes. It's like sexual repression, worship, Christianity. They play with a lot of frankly, there's almost too many themes that they delve into in this movie. But one of my favorite costumes in that movie is his name's Father Barr, and he is just this really nasty guy. He has a nasty attitude, but people kind of worship him. He's kind of like the Christian rock star. And what they did was like, and this was set in like the 17th century, I believe, and his costume, he kind of just looked like a rock star. They gave him like little tiny purple oval sunglasses. He had like the rock star hair. It really evoked the era of the 70s and that specific time, and the people that, you know, Ken Russell was around, you know, given that he's, you know, worked with The Who and all that jazz. It was really interesting to see that influence of the time, but also I liked that they played with kind of giving him sort of this like 17th century goes 70s, you know, glam rock star god, because they're different forms of worship. And so playing with that in the costume, I was just obsessed with. And, you know,
I gotta watch that.
Oh yeah. My goodness. There's like a girl that she's kind of known for being really jealous, and she has like green lipstick, which is absurd for the time, but I love that they did that, because it's like she's kind of like green with envy. She's jealous. And I love it. I highly, highly recommend it. I think a masterpiece.
Well, Tommy is one of my favorite musicals of all time too. And the movie version I love. What about any modern films that strike you from a costume design perspective in regards to horror? Because I find, I don't know, maybe we'll think differently in the future and we look back to this time and think, wow, there was a lot of really standout, unique looks. But I find a lot of modern horror doesn't have anything too exciting. When it's placed in the modern time.
I would agree. And it's modern horror is interesting right now, and it's almost like we're seeing a lot of like homage resurgence, especially since Stranger Things, where it's almost like people are craving that style, but we're like, maybe we're just not stylish anymore. We gotta call back to something else.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, are we getting boring? But I will say, you know, oftentimes like Midsommar, that is something that I think the costume design is spectacular.
Yeah, that's true.
And even down to having, you know, Danny in those like gray sweats, I think that that was like a good use of boring clothes. Because it really told her character's story. And you know, you got in the mind of that character, and that's something that, you know, as long as I think modern horror costuming, while sometimes can be visually boring, aside from the amazing flower dress in Midsommar, which was incredible, but it's as long as you are getting into the character's head, and that costume can tell their story and give you more context to their story that, you know, the dialogue can't, I think that that's where it succeeds. And so even if it's sometimes a little boring, I think it can still work. Things like Hereditary, where I'm like, the costuming didn't stand out to me, but it flowed really well with the production design and the tone of the film, and it made sense. And so I can at least appreciate it from that angle. But yeah, I would say like Midsommar is something that does stand out to me, particularly because they used like really old material to like make the dresses and the garments, and like everything was really intentional and down to the texture of the fabrics that they used. And so I thought that was pretty brilliant.
Yeah. And the thing about modern horror movies and just like modern fashion in general, like, because we're in it, we don't see it as anything spectacular. Mm-hmm. It's just regular, like us. Like, even when we look just 10 years ago, now it's like, I remember being in that era and thinking, what is our fashion now? Like, what is that? But now I can think, oh, I definitely know what it is. Like, when you look back on it. So,
exactly.
I remember seeing Scream in theaters and it just feeling like the most modern, you know, kind of just in regards to costumes, like kind of bland, like everybody just looked like a normal person.
Yeah.
And then when I rewatched that recently, I was like, was that made in the 80s?
I know.
The style of that era of 90s was still so, I mean, I don't even know what was going on, but.
Yeah, I would honestly like, I feel like doing modern, like, I've talked about this a little with some friends where it's like, if you do like a 2011 period piece now, that is so much harder than doing like a 70s period piece because you don't have that much to work off of. Right. You don't have those like tropes to like reference and be like, do I want more or less of that? You're just kind of like, we just came out of that. And like, I'm not sure. I think Uncut Gems is the one that was set in 2011 that my friend had brought up, and they were like, I thought they did a really good job. And I was like, yeah, gosh, I mean, it's difficult to do that. I mean, maybe now in like 2007, that's probably where it's like, okay, we could probably handle that period.
Right. There was like a clear delineation. Right. But yeah, Uncut Gems was kind of in that slipstream of like, between defining eras. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Black Christmas real quick.
Yes.
Because you mentioned in our emails that was one of your favorites. I assume you mean the original.
I do.
And if you don't, get out of here.
I feel so bad for not liking a lot of modern. I mean, I do like a lot of modern horror, but there's some that just like don't do it for me. I want it to, but you know,
and
I mean,
Bowser,
I think
we'll join the club.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm not a hard ass about it, but I'm also like, oftentimes the original is better. Totally. And Black Christmas is, I think, one of those. I do like the recent remake. But yeah, love the original. It feels so, that to me feels like 70s realism. Mm-hmm. And with like absolutely delicious set design that just goes so well with the costume design. And I think that that's just like an absolutely thrilling movie, or maybe not thrilling. It's creepy. It's a mystery and it's suspenseful. And I love it. Something I'm working on right now is trying to write a Black Hanukkah, because I'm like, give us a stylistic Hanukkah movie.
It. Yes.
And so that's something that my interest of Black Christmas sparked that. And I wanted to do, you know, I wanted to hop on doing the, you know, let's do an homage because it's more stylish, you know, like let's do a 70s Jewish horror just because it looks really fun. And, you know, if we didn't get it, so we deserve it.
Exactly. That would be so fun. Please write that.
I love that.
Yes. Black Christmas, what they do really well is making it feel real. And the characters oftentimes wear things that are like a little strange, like that massive fur coat. That was his own fur coat. And he just wanted to wear it and they let him wear it and it felt real. And sometimes that makes me think about how oftentimes when you have a good relationship with your actors as a costume designer, if they have pieces that fit their character, that they feel like fit their character, and they are already comfortable in those pieces, it's, you know, that can help them act better and that can help them sell it. And so that, when I think of Black Christmas, I think of that, because they did do a lot of that and they wore a lot of pieces that were their own, or they worked their own style into it. I would say that is something that stands out about that film for me.
That's great. And it had an ability to make things resonate and feel iconic, even though they were still realistic and somewhat understated. Like, I can remember Olivia Hussey's sweater throughout that whole movie. And I think that's a trick, is to not overstate something to force it being iconic, but yet it still remains. And I know this is a complete tangent, but I just think about Freddy Krueger often, all the time.
And all the time.
And in a way, his look is not, it shouldn't be as memorable as it is. The striped sweater is kind of, it's not as like vibrant as you remember it. When I revisit these things, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of round and red. It's kind of green and red. I don't know. The fedora, but yet it just got in there and it worked.
Yeah. It's almost like it's strange. Like, that is a strange costume, and it, like, in a really good way. It feels very real, but you're also like, what is he wearing?
Right.
But that's why it sticks, because it's not something that someone would have worn ever.
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's what makes a good monster costume, a good villain costume. And I think that, like, you know, a lot of it is like the distressing and the aging of the costumes that kind of really make it feel real and disturbing. And you're like, maybe, I mean, honestly, that striped sweater with the fedora, I would question if it was like not distressed, but when it's distressed, it's like you're questioning why he's wearing that, and you're also like, this is creepy. It adds to the environment of being creepy. And so it's that's a really good costume for that reason, because he's supposed to be creepy, and I think his costume is creepy.
And it feels like he's been in it for ages.
Forever. Exactly. That's I think that's a really good example of a solid villain costume.
Mm-hmm. So what are you currently working on, Emma?
So I'm currently working on our next Monstrous Femme Films project, which is going to be directed by Hannah, and it's going to be a 70s period piece. So that's going to be really fun to costume design. I'm also producing and art directing. And so it's going to be a massively fun project, and we're really excited about it. And then I'm currently writing my next short, which is going to be a psychological surreal horror. It's called Penny and the Poppies, and it's going to be a 60s girl band horror. And I'm really excited about it. A lot of my costume design influences is the reason I want to make it, because I really just want to put people in cute clothes with a decent story, I hope. And then hopefully developing that Black Hanukkah idea more. But yeah, I'm just excited to make more stuff with Monstrous Femme Films. And yeah, that's what I'm currently working on, besides our online content, which has been really fun too.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Well, all of that sounds really exciting.
Thank you.
And speaking of monstrous, what is it? Monstrous Femme Film. It's a lot of words. Yeah. Monstrous Femme Film Collective. We've got Hannah in the room with us.
Hi. Welcome, Hannah.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Monstrous Femme Film Collective and how it began?
Yeah. So a few years ago, 2018, we decided that we wanted to make a horror short called Fanatico, which is like a neo-giallo inspired by Phenomena, Suspiria, all that stuff. And we spent like a year making it. We had no money. We had no experience. We were all students, and we were just friends kind of just making it for fun. And it kind of blossomed into something we wanted to continue with. So now we're developing this anthology where we're making these short films in the horror genre focused on uplifting women and queer folk in front of and behind the camera.
I love it. So tell us a little bit more about Fanatico. I liked it a lot. I thought it was really cool, but I also, the subgenre of all girl schools is like my favorite for some reason.
Why is that? Did you go to an all girl school?
I did. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So a lot of weird feelings about nuns.
there you go.
Yeah. I would love to know what the inspiration for the story was.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. Well, I lived in the Bible Belt for like 9 years. And I was surrounded by religion, Christianity, Catholicism, and I'm like a raging atheist. So
where in the Bible Belt specifically?
Oklahoma.
Okay, that's where my mom's from.
Really? Where?
Yeah, she's originally from Norman, I guess.
Stillwater.
Okay.
I'm not from there, but I did live there for a long time. So I developed, you know, this distaste for religious authority. And so that's kind of where that stemmed from. And then just, you know, sexual liberation and issues with that as well.
Were there any specific giallo films that you wanted to pay homage to, even down to like, so were there certain compositions you wanted to recreate or lighting effects? Because that's all over the place in Fanatico. And I know that's a big stamp of the giallo movies, is like real dramatic lighting shifts and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would say the story and like the supernatural, like powers that the main character has, definitely phenomena. Mm-hmm. We even tried to cast an actress who kind of reminded us of the young Jennifer Connelly. And then the lighting, Suspiria, mm-hmm. for sure. And there were a lot of shots that, because we were making it on such a shoestring budget, didn't make it in, that I had hoped would make it in. And those were like Tenebrae and Bava and Fulci. But I would say Phenomena and Suspiria were the big ones.
I want people to reference Phenomena more often. I feel like it's not one of the go-tos, but I love that movie.
It's my favorite. Yeah, it's my favorite Argento. It's so good.
So, you know, you made it very clear what you are fans of, and you pay homage to that and have a lot of references. So when you're doing something that is so referential, how do you include your personal stamp on it? Like, how do you, when people watch your films, how do they know that this is a monstrous film? Wait, what? Oh my God.
Femme Twister.
Like, how would they know, or that it's a Hannah film, or that it's an Emma film? Like, how do you keep you in there while it's still being referential?
I think that comes with subversion of tropes, which we've done in both films. And kind of modernizing the message of a lot of those films. Like Giallo, they're very, I love them, but they're very misogynistic. Uh-huh. Same with the summer camp slashers. Uh-huh. And so I think adding like a modern twist and like a feminist message, definitely, you know, it's kind of our stamp.
Yeah, I would say I would completely agree. And it's also like, I know with something I want to do is like tell stories that weren't necessarily told, like I'm trying to write a queer story that maybe wouldn't be touched on in the 60s, you know, things like mm-hmm. that. And so you know, generally the message I think behind Monstrous Femme Films is that we want to tell stories in ways they haven't been told before. And ways we want to showcase the representation that we haven't seen, or the films that we haven't been able to see before. And, you know, like Hannah said, her films have subverted from these tropes because it's like, oh, I love this movie, I love this slasher, but then it's kind of tainted by the misogyny. And you're like, I don't enjoy this as much because of this factor. And being able to do that in, you know, these films and our upcoming films is, you know, of interest. And then also just being able to make really fun stylistic pieces that showcase our personal style.
Yeah, we're kind of like remaking the movies that we all love, but for us, I guess.
That's awesome.
I know that I bring this up on the show a lot, but a problem I have when I watch old things is that I can't get out of my like modern mindset where I'm just kind of like, oh, he just like threw the F word, like, like the homophobic F word, you know, like, it's like, I can't get over it. But then at the same time, there is so much beauty in like old movies. So I do love that's what you're doing, because you're basically saying, hey, this is what's good about those movies, and we're just going to make it better.
I think that's an awesome way in, because we talk about that a lot on this podcast, that there can be, and I admittedly did like a lot of, this podcast could just be like Bowser reinvestigates problematic favorites that he had when he was a kid, because as a kid, a lot of that stuff went over my head. So I have this relationship to some older material it's just endeared itself to me. Mm-hmm. And then we'll watch it on the podcast and Sapphire will be like, and also, you know, it's like highly problematic. And I'm like, yeah, but that monster effect was so good.
I know. So
I love the idea of going back into the things that you love about those films, but making the messages better. And I mean, a lot of those old films didn't have a message at all too. Mm-hmm. Well, we talked to Emma a bit about how she got into horror, and it was through sci-fi and B movies. What was your way in, Hannah? Especially coming from the Bible Belt, did you have to, mm-hmm. I remember I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast, but I was on a youth group trip and with my church and didn't want to be there and, you know, wanted to be anywhere else. And I was like, I'm going to go down the street and rent a movie and come back. And my youth leader, my youth pastor was like, okay, but we're all about to like go do something on the boardwalk or whatever. It was in Ocean City, Maryland. And I was like, y'all have fun. I'm going to rent a movie. And I rented Texas Chainsaw Massacre and came back and put it on in the house, like the house that we were all staying at for this youth trip. And my pastor allowed it because he was like, you know, I'll let you sit here and watch this because I think it's an example of like man's depravity to man. And he had to frame it in some kind of, you know, religious teaching angle.
That's so funny. That literally happened to me when I was trying to, I would like force my friends in my rural town to like sit down and watch Possession or Orphan.
Yeah.
And I'm like, watch this. We're having fun.
Right. This is happening.
They're like, oh, okay.
What did you do, Hannah? Were you allowed to watch movies like that?
I was. My mom's a huge horror fan.
Oh, that's God. Great.
Goosebumps for me.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with Goosebumps. Yeah, I love Goosebumps. And Scream as well was a big one. And like Tim Burton, you know, all the gateway stuff.
90s, what's up? It's my era.
Yeah. For both of you, when you look at the landscape of modern horror, what do you feel like is lacking? What do you hope to see more of? And maybe it's through your own personal creations, but what kind of shift would you like to see in the horror movies that we see nowadays?
Style.
Yeah.
I was thinking that
color,
too.
Color.
I was thinking that.
When we started making Fanatico, it was mainly because we were like, the horror genre is severely lacking in style and color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And fashion. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I would also agree, style and color. And I think that, I don't know, I think a lot of it is also, oddly enough, color grading. I feel like horror right now, and horror for the last like 10 years, it's maybe coming out of it, very gray. It's very gray, and I'm bored. And I know that like Stranger Things kind of revitalized that, but I, you know, like we talked about earlier, you know, a lot of modern horror, it's like either boring or it's an homage. And I would like to bridge the gap. Like I want to see modern horror play with color because there's color to play with. It's everywhere. There's so many ways to do it that I crave it. I want it. Mm. It's what we all deserve.
And it can still be scary.
Yeah. Color, yes.
Colorful films can still be scary. I don't know what this like disconnect is.
There was a real shift into everything just being drab. Like horror meant drab. It meant sun stained and you know, gritty in a way that was like concrete and wood. And even all the posters were just like streaks of dark oil on wood. Yeah. That was the texture. If you Google horror texture, it's like that's what comes up is someone spilled
a
paint. Like, what? Stain can on wood. Yeah.
When did we get into this era of like horror movies have to be very, very darkly lit and like no color at all?
Maybe like 2010. I don't know. Maybe earlier. What comes to mind is like things like The Conjuring or Insidious, which are like arguably fun, but so
dark.
Gray.
They're very, just dark. Very,
Not stylistic.
That's true, like, actually.
I think they ushered in like an era of kind of. Yeah, browns and tans and grays as your horror palette. And maybe even like I don't remember the year, but what year was the Chainsaw remake? Because I feel like the Texas Chainsaw remake worked for a lot of people. And that set the tone. That set the tone, I know, for like trailers. Every trailer had the like sound effect because that was in the Texas Chainsaw trailer. But I don't know, maybe Hostel too. Hostel was part of that.
I was going to say like, when they started doing all the remakes of the older horror movies, but they were like the darker, like modernized versions, maybe around then.
Yeah.
That makes
maybe
sense.
Maybe Saw. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. But also, I don't know. Even like early Saw, it's like fine. But then you get like, even with, I don't know, the later it gets, the darker and, you know, it's kind of like grimy. Like they want it to look grimy.
Yeah.
And then I just felt like the, like Jigsaw, that was just also so gray. It just like got worse. It's like, oh, we're doing a remake of something that was already like kind of dark and grimy and gray, but then making it more dark. Not to say I don't absolutely enjoy the Saw franchise unabashedly.
It's like my favorite franchise.
It's so I fun. I would, oh my God, I would die so for Tobin Bell. I would die for him. Love Mark
He'll
Hoffman.
Probably die before you.
Yeah.
Well, Emma and Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great conversation. Where can people find you each on social media and Monstrous Femme Films?
Thank you so much for having us. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Python Patsy. And then you can find Monstrous Femme Films on Instagram at Monstrous Femme Films. And then our Twitter is Monstrous_Femme. And then our website is Monstrous Femme Films if you want to learn more about us and what we're up to. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Hannah Mae Film. And you can check out our film on Altar called Fanatico.
Perfect. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. We've had a great time.
All right, Altar Society, listen up. This week, we're watching Evil Eye on Amazon Prime Video. So watch it and join us next week when we discuss what we thought.
Before we sign off, here's what's coming up on Altar. On February 7th, we celebrate Black History Month with a collection of shorts from some amazing Black filmmakers like Brian Keith Montgomery, Jeffrey Reddick, Khalid Ridgway, and many more. On February 8th, The Lover. With her engagement to Brad, Lisa thought she had finally found the one. Now, Brad has ended the relationship, and Lisa is not sure if she can go on. And on February 10th, Dead Hearts. A young mortician learns that not even death can stand in the way of true love. A whimsical, gothic bedtime story filled with love, loss, taxidermy, kung fu, and biker werewolves. That's all for this week's episode. Until next time, stay altered.
You can catch new episodes of Alter Weekly every Thursday. Get it wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure to subscribe and download. Alter Weekly is produced by Andrew Bowser, with theme music by Sapphire Sandalo. Alter Weekly is executive produced by Stephen Michael and Lauren Palmer at Gunpowder and Sky.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.